Hey everyone, welcome to News in the Money World. Welcome, Rupert Carline. How you doing, Rupert?
I'm very well. How are you this morning, Gussie?
Very good. Awesome. There is tons to get through. We're going to be talking about some of the unwinds in the carry trade, the VIX. We're going to talk about the new normal, good news being good news again. Talk about Bitcoin, why we're not taken off to the moon just yet. And then we'll finish up a little bit of local news around what's happening in New Zealand with the OCR announcement coming through on the 14th of August. When are we going to see lower interest rates? When are things going to get back to normal in the property market? So big chat today. Let's get cracking with this Japanese carry trade. That was the news. Like, that was the big thing that we were talking about last week, wasn't it? Because that was kind of when it was. Yeah. And my big question to you, just to start off with, is it over?
It's a great question. I think, no one really knows the truth and the answer to that. There's a view that kind of 60, 70% unwound, but it does feel as though there's still a little bit left. And I think, it's a really big question because investors have been truly, truly, a lot of money has been lost on this carry trade. So just for those that are unaware, what the carry trade means is people were borrowing in Japanese yen because interest rates in Japan are still close to zero, still some of the lowest in the world. And they've been using that money to invest in assets in other parts of the world, which have got materially higher returns. And so this was all great because at a world when the kind of you're getting low cost of funding in Japan, you're able to put it into park it in US treasuries and kind of significantly higher. At the same time, you had a world where the Japanese yen continued to weaken. So therefore, because the inflation was still low, interest rates were low, there was no prospect of that changing, the yen continued to weaken. And what that means is that actually you kind of went, cool, so I can borrow yen at a low cost. I can invest in my US treasuries, get a decent return. And even better, because the yen is going to weaken, when I go to pay that money back, it's actually going to be worth a whole lot less. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like a double win, really, until it wasn't. Yeah. And then the day the exchange rate moved the other way, where all of a sudden, over the last couple of weeks, the Japanese yen strengthened by 10-15%, that wiped out that entire investing strategy basically overnight, plus a whole lot more, right? Because now all of a sudden, you were borrowing it at 1% or 2% and investing it at 5%. But actually, if the value of the yen that you kind of have to pay back has gone up by 10%, that means you're kind of out by quite a lot. And this gets even worse when you put a whole lot of leverage and all that kind of stuff in behind it, right? So that's how people have lost on this carry trade. It was a very popular trade to make. And then the big question, as you rightly ask at the start, how much of this is left and where's it kind of going to go next? And I don't think anyone really knows. That all of the stuff that I've read indicates that they think most of it's gone and most of it's been wiped out. But who knows? It's a really good example of popular trades when they get started. When they start to unwind, like, they move quickly. And it's kind of, they can pretty quickly turn into a freight train.
Yeah. The fact that people come out right away and say that, like, I think it was JP Morgan, I could be wrong, Jamie Dimon that said this, or somebody said it, like, it was a good chunk of it was done, right? We don't really need to worry about it. But this has been happening for like 30 years, right? Where the value is just constantly been going in one direction, creating more and more incentive for traders on both sides to borrow here, goose the returns with leverage to get better returns here, and then repay the debt, which is now in a depreciated currency over here. Like, that's been going on for a while. And so surely at some stage, there's always a limit, right? There's always a finite space and time. There's an ending to all these things. And that would have been known. So I guess it's probably more like the pace at which the Bank of Japan decided to increase their benchmark interest rate and the words that went along with it, and maybe also the language coming out of the US Fed that was being used, which wasn't quite calibrated on both sides, indicating that maybe people involved in that carry trade hadn't got those parameters right in terms of, like, they would have priced in the likelihood of strengthening and weakening currencies and strengthening and weakening interest rates. But it was probably more just the change of it that caught people off guard. Would you say that would be about right?
Yeah, but I think I debate that. I mean, everyone knew, and for a long time, people have known inflation was kind of getting to the end in Japan. They'd moved out of deflation world. We were kind of hitting in that 2-3% barrier. The Reserve Bank of Japan had held off for a long time. But people still kept on piling into this trade, right? And that's the real problem. So I think the problem that you get is people take bets. And to be fair, this was just another one of those bets. As much as in hindsight, it's really obvious and easy to see and to say that actually inflation was beaten in Japan. There is the central bank in Japan have been talking for quite a long time about potentially increasing interest rates. So what were people doing this? You're 100% right, but they still did it.
Yeah, no.
And that's the beauty about markets. Everyone wants to take a view.
Yeah. Yeah, or everybody keeps on doing something and as long as it has always worked. And then they'll form an entire thing around that.
I think even that's too strong, right? As long as it's working right now.
Sure.
I mean, at the end of the day, we've seen carry trades. It always unwinds. It always ends badly. I mean, there are so many examples of this equivalent strategy, and it never works in the long run. The trick is, and this is the part to it, is most people back themselves to get out before that flip happens, before the switch happens. And clearly, the switch happened faster here than people had thought when, again, Japan central bank said, hold on a sec, we are going to start moving higher on interest rates. And that was the flip that needed to happen.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's why hedge funds and a lot of these active kind of the big funds are brilliant because on one hand, they'll sit there and they'll go, yep, we're going to win here and we're going to place these bets and they're awesome when they work. But the same reason why a hedge fund is up 30% in a year will be the same reason they're down 50% the next year.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. But going back to what you were saying just before around, it's really like a strategy, right? Like there are investment products or there's assets that you could buy and some are more volatile than others. And a good portfolio has a little bit of everything. But there's also strategies which you can use that are a little bit higher risk than others. And the yen carry trade is a strategy. And I think what a lot of everyday investors might be tempted to do with property is kind of like a version of this, right? Where people borrow money from their bank. And over time, we know, thanks to the magic of inflation, that the value of that money or that currency really goes down over time. So it is depreciating in terms of purchasing power. But we're borrowing that to buy something that is kind of going up in value. So we're kind of doing a version of a carry trade when we're shorting the dollars and we're going long on property. And then we close out the trade later on by selling that property at a higher price.
Yeah, 100%. Because the honest truth is that, and the reason why it works on property is because we don't mark to market. A property where we will value it once every 6, 12, 24, 36 months, they're not liquid. So you can't, it's not like a share where you can get a price every single day. I mean, to be fair, in the share market, you can actually go, or Bitcoin, share market, you can go on lots of places where they will give you leverage. Not so much here in New Zealand, but if you're overseas, it's really easy to find websites that will give you leverage to trade shares.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the reason why that's so much riskier in the share world versus the property world is when you do that in shares, A, they're priced every single day. And so they'll always move. Everyone knows exactly what you've got. And B, the transaction costs of closing out the trade is so small and it can happen infinitesimally, it goes wrong. And so it's kind of it's really interesting that analogy because leverage works in the property market because the market is inefficient and illiquid. So not a very good market for financial instruments. It doesn't work so well in the share market because it's highly liquid and the pricing is every day highly visible. And so that's why we kind of, but people try and forget about that. And that's why we often see high leverage in trading situations causes blow-ups. And I think that's what we saw last week, right? We saw it in Japan with the Japan carry trade. We've seen it the VIX and kind of the volatility indices and a whole lot of volatility funds, which again, people investing off the back of low volatility, leveraging up to get into some of this stuff. And then the moment the volatility hits a level, bang, automatically sold out because those sells happen within seconds and you're just done. And that kind of, and again, the first few sells happen and a few more sells and it creates a snowball that just keeps on rolling down that hill.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, market regulators have recognized this, which is why most big exchanges in the world now have got stop outs. So in the US and the S&P, and sorry, in the New York Stock Exchange and also the NASDAQ, if it's more than 7.5% drop on a day, trading halts for half an hour. So everyone can stop, they get their heads on, all of these forced liquidations stop, and then they go, cool, allows people to take a bit of a reset. And to be fair, that's kind of what we saw last week on Friday and then again on Monday. Some bad news on Friday morning, kicked it off. You followed that. That kind of kicked off some selling. Volatility indices kind of went strong. At the same time, you went, hold on a sec. Are we about to get an emergency rate cut out of the Fed because the economy is dive balling? That meant that the US dollar plummeted, Japanese yen soared, all the liquidity and all the leverage in that trade, bang, that got wiped out. Volatility in the US soared. That meant all the people that had invested in the volatility style funds and anyone that had leverage, again, they quit closeouts. And it just snowballed on itself and happened really, really quick.
Yeah. So carrying on from that, like the other area, which is like, we're talking like Black Diamond Run in terms of complexity, in my mind anyway, understanding the Japanese yen carry trade versus understanding trading volatility, that's next level for me anyway, right? And I kind of understand roughly what the VIX is, the volatility index, and that I know the S&P 500 has something to do with that and calls and puts options and divergence and convergence around that. Effectively, when there's massive changes happening, then the volatility index spikes and we create financial products off of the back of that, or there are financial products off the back of that where you can specifically go long and go short on this volatility index itself. So we're talking about a complicated financial product, which can also be leveraged. So like, this is just mind blowing in terms of, and I'm sure this is like basic when you really understand this, there's levels and levels and levels. But what I find interesting about this is that you've got these funds, these automatic funds, or these systematic funds, I should say, which are programmed, I guess, to self-execute certain trades. And when volatility will spike, they're programmed to sell, sell, sell. And so kind of like the unwind of the carry trade, you can create, or you can see how there are other areas or pockets of markets which could then cascade and snowball and create liquidations all over the show, effectively just taking everybody's chips off the table, right? And so we kind of saw a little bit of that happening last week too. It's wacky out there, right? Like when things really want to get messy, they can get messy properly still. Like it's not like we've fixed markets and they behave themselves, right?
And this is why Warren Buffett has called in the past derivatives weapons of mass destruction, because he doesn't believe that people actually understand what's gone into these derivatives. And he doesn't understand where they end up and where they go. And to be fair, I think we saw a fair amount of that last Friday, Monday. A lot of that was down to the volatility trades, again, which is a synthetic derivative, which, yeah, who knows why, to be blunt, why those are traded and why they're being created. We kind of know why, but do they need to be? Probably not. It is an interesting set of conversations, right, where we've created financial instruments for the sake of creating financial instruments. And every now and then it backfires.
Yeah. And maybe a part of this is kind of like a cathartic sort of therapeutic process where it forces people to get liquidated and injects a bit of pain just to remind people that, hey, volatility is real and you can lose your money. And maybe that's kind of what we need to get back to this new world where good news is good news again and bad news is bad news, because it feels like we've come out of that place where we're expecting bad news so that interest rates drop, so that asset prices go up. But I think we talked about this last week, I can't remember, interest rates go down because the central banks are trying to stimulate the economy, and they're trying to stimulate the economy because the economy's tanked. And so you kind of have to understand, actually, no, that's not a good thing at the moment if interest rates go down, because something bad has happened. And it's not as simple as going, yeah, let's pile into tech and crypto now because rates have dropped, right? Is good news again, do you think, though?
Apparently it is. And if we looked at the correlations that we saw last week, so the ultimate way of understanding whether good news is good news and bad news is good news is, so the correlation, the traditional correlations work. So last week we saw that bad economic news meant that stock markets went down, interest rates went up. So a balanced portfolio did what a balanced portfolio is meant to do.
Yeah.
Back into the week when we had strong economic data, we saw the opposite, right? We saw interest rates shoot up a little bit. So the value of our bond portfolio fell and the value of our equity. And so to me, that's a really strong signal that we are back into a normalish world where good news is good news and bad news is bad news.
Hmm. That's good. That's, or unless it's bad, of course.
but it's kind of like, it's, yeah, as I was talking to someone very smart last week, and he said to me, you're in the genius territory. And so what he said, so can we safely say now that the Reserve Bank and central banks and US Fed have been telling everyone that we need to get unemployment up and that we're not going to reduce interest rates until unemployment is up. Markets are saying we need to get unemployment, we need to kind of get interest rates down to save the markets. And the first hint that we have a weak employment data and unemployment's rising, markets plummet and hit it. He's like, how do we keep up? Like, how do we follow this? And I think that the narrative that we have at the moment is so confused and we're so uncertain of this environment over the last 4 or 5 years. That's why we're seeing these market reactions. And I hate to say it, we're likely to see a whole lot more of these market reactions over the next kind of 12, 24 months.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think as it relates to New Zealand property in particular, this is one of the questions, probably a really uncomfortable question, I guess, that I've been asking myself is, will interest rates dropping, because that now kind of seems inevitable between now and Christmas, that there'll be at least some drop of some sort, will that really ignite the sentiment that needs to be ignited again to trigger a lot more buying in the property space? Or will it be connected to a lot more fear that people are losing their jobs and that inflation hasn't really been dealt with yet? And is the interest rate piece actually going to take a backseat for a while until it falls a lot further? I don't buy into this whole concept that lower interest rates is immediately good for house prices. It just doesn't make sense, especially when you understand that the reason why those rates are going down is because probably unemployment has spiked. More or less the same thing of what you said before with equity markets. So
yeah. No, you're 100% right. And look, we don't know what the answer here is, right? We're all saying that the current New Zealand recession, very close to recession, is an interest rate driven recession. And I think there is the assumption that all of a sudden interest rate starts to fall and then we're back on our magical way and nothing shifts. I hope that's right. I'm probably not. Well, I'm a natural skeptic, so I don't believe that. But whether that's my skepticism or that's reality, only time will tell. But I think the property market, you are 100% right. I mean, when we look at what happened in 2008, it was a good kind of probably the last time that we saw a big fall in the property market. The truth was that the property market fell. I think that fell about 15% from top to bottom. And it took a good 6 to 9 months after 6 months after interest rates had started falling and been cut before we started to see that reversal in the property market. And it took a good 2 or 3 years before the market got back to where it had been in back end of 2008. And so, yeah, I think we do need to be careful assuming that, cool, if people are saying, hey, look, we might get our first interest rate cut in October, house prices are back to normal by Christmas, no way. I suspect if kind of what we've seen in the past is a trend that continues, we'll start to see a very slow recovery from kind of Q1, Q2 next year. Yeah. That feels more likely because people still need to be able to afford these houses.
Yeah, and it'll take a while for the inflation mechanism to flow through to the salaries to the point that it needs to. But the good news is that there's other things going on. There was a minor tax cut that finally passed through. And that actually, I was doing the numbers for somebody before using the bank's loan servicing calculators that we have to provide when we're submitting loan applications off to the banks. And it was about $20,000 or so was the impact to borrowing power from these tax cuts. So this was a couple that was earning combined household income of $200,000. And I think it was just a little bit over 20 grand that they could borrow more in addition. Now, that's not exact, but it's close. And so these are some of the little things that are going to help. And when the official cash rate here in New Zealand does drop, that will also have a significant impact in terms of borrowing power, because typically the banks will lend 40% of your gross income is what they will allow you to have as a mortgage payment. They'll test you at 50%, but they'll allow you to be spending up to 40% of your gross income on mortgage payments. And that's kind of a constant, but as interest rates fall, that increases borrowing power and that increases the force or the buying pressure on property prices, which can push prices up. But I think that's just going to take a while for all of those factors to flow through effectively. That's my gut. And I hear what you're saying around 2008. It was probably until 2011, 2012 even, before the property market really started to amp up. And it was pretty chilled for about four years there, really, following the global financial crisis. And so we're not that far into this correction. I know it's totally different circumstances, but it can take a bit longer.
Anyway, yeah, I agree. At least we can hope that the prices have stopped falling.
Yeah, exactly. Stabilize, right?
So, and I think that's an important benchmark for people, right? I do think the one thing that is a bit different from where we were in 2008 is the fact that we have is the immigration numbers. The immigration numbers, I'm kind of surprised. They seem to be amazingly sticky and amazingly high. But, yeah, that's probably one of the big differences between here and 2008 is we've got very strong immigration and we've got a massive shortage of housing, a much stronger shortage of housing, much larger shortage of housing than we had back in 2008.
Yeah. Mm, okay. So we kind of have skipped ahead and we've talked about let's tie a bow on that conversation around the New Zealand economy, property, and the official cash rate. So we have an official cash rate announcement happening as we're recording. We don't really know what the outcome is going to be. We were saying before we hit record that, you believe that they're probably not going to do anything. I think I'd probably be inclined to agree with you, but you would be of the opinion that when it comes to October, which is the next time they'll be reviewing this, we're probably going to see a reduction. Would that be correct?
I mean, my view is based on the fact that they now have a single mandate, which is inflation. And I think I'm not convinced that we're probably where we need to be yet on inflation. Wage growth is still kind of in that 3 to 4% range, which is what I looked at last night from Stats New Zealand. Mm. And we know we've got big supply chain issues, a whole lot of other issues, right? So I think it's kind of inflation might drop to 3% by the end of the year, but there's a bit of pressure there. So I think if they're going to live by that single mandate that they've been given, then it's pretty hard to argue that. And I think tax cuts, it's another big one, right? So when you've got $100 a fortnight going to families, they're going to be spending that money. To individuals, they'll be spending that money. And see how much of that actually kind of gets spent and what does that do to the inflationary pressure, right? Because at the end of the day, if you've got a $500,000 mortgage, that tax cut alone is probably worth kind of 0.5% on your mortgage rate.
Right.
So it's doing the same thing.
Yeah. I'm just having a look here for our next topic here as we come in for a landing, just having a look at the price of Bitcoin, which I try not to do more than 4 or 5 times an hour. Yeah, just a smidgen over $59,000 at the time of recording. You could almost use the price of Bitcoin as a timestamp for these podcast episodes. And all I can say is that there's interesting dynamics at play. It's kind of like an extension of that conversation where good news is good news again. Politicians, they love to give us what we ask for, right? Just to buy votes. But it's interesting to see the flippening here occur between politicians kind of getting angry at all types of crypto because it's scammers use it, it's of the devil, right? That's kind of flipped around. And now talking about crypto is actually good for politicians. It's great for votes to a certain degree now that they realize that actually cat's out of the bag. The vast majority of people are at least open to it. Then you've got mainstream fund managers, Fidelity, BlackRock, with their ETFs launched earlier this year. That's kind of infiltrating traditional finance to the point now where you kind of stand out now for being against Bitcoin when now these big fund managers are for it. And then we're kind of getting on the other side of these hacks, Mt. Gox, where funds are actually being returned to people where it was taken from. And it's kind of like building this confidence, this 360 degree view of confidence now being restored. Bit of a rocky start. It's kind of like having a teenager. Eventually they kind of come out of it, I'm told. But it's maturing. And I just wonder if maybe at some stage we're going to see Bitcoin break free from the traditional correlation of, say, tech stocks, not to be considered a risk asset anymore, but to be considered something completely other, because that's where I think we're going to see some real value. But my question to you, Rupert, despite all these really positive things happening, why do you think we haven't seen the price of Bitcoin soar so far this year?
That's the question, right? That's the bit that I struggle with and I struggle to understand. I think you've never seen a better setup in the crypto space. And we've got a combination of, politicians that are helpful. You've got institutional investors that are starting to get there. You got support from the behemoths of BlackRock and Fidelity. Still a low liquidity, which is kind of pretty scary. Still quite a lot of leverage in that system, which is kind of between the high levels of leverage because it's pretty easy to go get a margin account for retail investors in crypto land, plus also the low liquidity. That explains the volatility. But I am a little bit surprised that we haven't kind of broken out north, right? Because even as you talked about, you alluded to the Mt. Gox kind of hack. You alluded to, right? Fascinating world that we live in where actually the shit that's gone really wrong in crypto, people are getting their money back plus some. And so, yeah, I'm kind of a little bit confused about why it hasn't gone a little bit further in this current environment. I think the only thing that I can come back to and think about is actually was a lot of this preordained in the first quarter where you kind of had that run-up post-ETFs. But I'm kind of really surprised and confused that we haven't seen a whole lot more, because I don't think you're going to get a better market setup than this, right? It's pretty unusual that you get all of these kind of things coming together at the same time. And particularly, I mean, Kamala Harris, when I looked at it this morning, was talking about she has decided that she needs to get back all of these Silicon Valley donors from Donald Trump. And crypto is going to be an important way for her to do that. Yeah, I'm really, really positive on the asset class. And I'm a little bit surprised it hasn't already gone, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, like politicians, though, are funny, right? It's like got mom and dad, they're splitting up. We get two Christmases. Fantastic, right? That's kind of what it feels like. It feels like they're competing for the hearts and minds, the affections of those that are in tech and crypto. And you're right, like that's a massive one. I guess there's probably this backdrop of geopolitical concerns. I wonder how much of the Japanese yen carry trade piece and the crypto thing might be connected. Maybe some of that buying pressure has come from that dynamic. Maybe. I don't know, but like it feels like the setup is there, but this is, and we have to be careful saying this because we haven't had that long of a track record with Bitcoin. And so we can't really say with certainty that because of where we are at with the typical four-year cycle with Bitcoin, that it's going to pop in the exact same way that it always has. We always need to keep that in mind. Bitcoin will always prove to the investor what it really is, I think, over and above these models that we try to overlay on it. So I think there is this, probably kind of similar to the property market right now here in New Zealand, there is this expectation that it will perform and that the risk is gone and that there's no reason why it'll be different this time around. So it's like it's a sure thing. It'll double, then it'll pull back to around 60 grand and stay there as the new low for the next crypto winter, and then it'll take off again. That's kind of like the consensus view. And I hope that's true. But I think we always have to be weighing the other side of this as well and being skeptical on our own assumptions here. I think there's a good chance that things could go completely differently. Alien disclosure, right? What would happen then? Or supercomputers, who knows, right? I don't believe in the supercomputer piece, that's for sure. But I think stranger things have happened. But we will know soon. Same thing with property, right? Like we'll know probably by this time next year where property sits, for sure. And we'll probably know for sure this time next year where Bitcoin sits. And therefore, all the rest of crypto. It's just a matter of what happens between now and then and what's the best strategy, right?
Well, and the truth is, in this current environment where it's uncertain, the one thing we do know, leverage is not your friend. Yeah. Because when you've got highly levered assets, you can get closed out on. And that's what leverage does not give you, is time. And often in these uncertain times, what you need is time to make sure that you can see through to the other side of the cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. Diversification. Asset allocation, set your long-term course settings, forget the short-term noise, right? Awesome. Well, on that sound advice, which is not financial advice, of course, let's finish up this episode next week.
I'm happy to say low levels of leverage is a good financial advice. I'm happy to put my hand up and wear that one if I ever get sued for that one.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty safe. That's awesome, though. Now, this time next week, again, it might be a completely different discussion with all the interesting geopolitical events happening in the world, certainly around interest rates and a whole bunch of data coming out of the U.S. So let's hang on tight for another interesting week and look forward to the conversation next week.
Awesome. I can't wait to it. It'll be a different world again by this time next week.
Guaranteed.
Very different world today than it was last Tuesday when we spoke.
That's right. Cheers, man. See ya.
Okay. Thank you. We'll speak soon. Bye-bye.
Cool, man. All right.